Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and I'm hosting this new podcast about how we talk to each other across differences of belief or identity or community. And part of the rationale behind that is an experience I've had over the last year. I've spent some time away on maternity leave, and as part of that, I really decided to switch myself off from some of our big public conversations, from social media in particular, and from the news cycle, in order to really focus on that time with my family. But for those of us who feel a sense of wanting to contribute to the world, of wanting to engage with wider society, tempting as it was, we can't stay away forever. So I re-engaged with our public conversations reasonably recently and discovered just how much had changed even in a few short months. It feels like our debate is even more fractured. We're even more prepared to write each other off, caricature each other, to talk past each other, to stereotype, to hurl insults, and to assume bad faith. I think we all feel this, that we've become deeply polarised, both across and within supposed communities, identities, and beliefs. And to be quite honest, I'm scared that our ability to truly engage with each other in order to be able to work together for the common good is faltering. Mark Thompson, the former Director General of the BBC, is now on the board of the New York Times, and he actually gave the very first Theos annual lecture many years ago, has said recently that we are increasingly reluctant to even try to find a common language with which to engage with people and cultures whose values differ substantially from our own. And that matters. It matters for all of us. But it definitely matters for religious people, for Christians like me who believe we have something good and true and beautiful to offer, to hold out humbly, who want to be in public, serving society, inviting people into community and the adventure of faith. So I'm working on a hunch that no one really wants a public language that's so painful and exhausting, that it is actually better for everyone if we treat each other like human beings, if we really listen and refuse to kick back, even when people, as they almost always are somewhere, infuriating and just so wrong. So how about, rather than trying to fix our divides in order to be able to talk to each other, we started talking to each other, trying to understand each other in the hope that it might be a shortcut to healing some of those deep differences, or at least help us live better with them. So that's going to be the theme of these conversations. And of course, like all good podcasts, it's partly just an excuse for me to have a natter with some really lovely, interesting people and introduce you to them. They come from all kinds of different backgrounds, beliefs and roles in public life, but they're all thoughtful about how we live together well and what role religion, faith and spirituality might have to play in that. Today you're going to listen into a conversation I had with Pippa Evans, who's a performer and an improviser mainly in the comedy world. You might know her from Showstoppers, which are these extraordinary bespoke improvised musicals, or from hilarious topical songs on The Now Show on Radio 4. Her recent song on the sexual harassment crisis, which goes, you need to look this up, "Don't touch people who don't want to be touched," has been stuck in my head for weeks. On the side, in her, I'm sure, copious spare time, she is the co-founder of the Sunday Assembly globally, chair of their board, and continues to host the London Gathering. And we're going to hear quite a lot more about what the Sunday Assembly is. I spoke to her about her childhood crush on Jesus, what led her to set up what's been dubbed the Atheist Church, and how she's always swum against the tide. We recorded at Pippa's flat in Stockwell, so you can hear a little bit of the children in the playground outside her window, which I think is probably a good thing to have in the background of conversations about the big stuff. As you were growing up, what was the kind of religious, spiritual, believing, unbelieving climate in which young Pippa was raised with her, I assume, pigtails and pickles?
Well, it's funny that you asked me this, actually, because I've just been rereading my teenage diaries for a Radio 4 project called My Teenage Diary, which means I'm quite well versed in what I was like as a teenager. And that is desperately in love with Jesus himself. Yeah. In fact, in my diary, there's a list of my top men. It says, number one, Jesus, brackets, obviously. So, but I wasn't actually brought up in a... So that was a Baptist church that I was belonged to when I was 14. But actually, when I was, I brought up in very much a C of E kind of what I call a Richard Curtis church. You right. know, everyone lovely. There's a church choir and putting on pantomimes, that kind of thing. You yeah. know, so a very lovely upbringing.
Was Rowan Atkinson, in fact, the vicar?
He could have been. It was, in fact, Peter Watkins. Who I know, Peter, if you're listening, I did promise I'd ring you and we'd go for lunch, and we will still do that. So I was brought up in that kind of community version of church, which would, I think, is the best way to explain Church of England. Is there's very much you're a part of a family, but the emphasis is more on you looking out for each other and stuff, and the Bible and stuff is there, but it's not, maybe the emphasis isn't quite so much on your own relationship with Jesus, which when I went to Baptist church I just loved as a teenager. The pop songy style of the music, I mean, I just loved this. Music's a big part of my life anyway, and I just thought, like, oh, this is great, so much better than the stuffy hymns. And I just thought it was great to go to Soul Survivor, these big Christian camps and stuff. Yeah, and absolutely was in love with Jesus. And then when I was 17, I sort of stopped believing. My mum's theory is that church was my cocoon, mm-hmm. and that it was a safe place for me to be in my teenage years, where I was becoming a woman. And then once I was a woman, well, the beginnings of being a woman, is one ever fully a woman? That's for a different podcast. Once I was sort of in a safe place as that in my development, I left. I stopped believing in God. And there's a great quote, who said it, maybe you know, is I don't believe in God anymore, but boy do I miss him.
It's Julian Barnes.
Great quote. And I think that's sort of how I left church, going, oh, and so I left not believing in God anymore and feeling a bit lonely. And then I realised that actually wasn't God I missed, it was church. And I really missed that community thing, which might be because that's where I'd started with church, is actually more that community vibe than the spiritual stuff.
So
that was my sort of upbringing. Interestingly, I've got three brothers, and they used to be hideous to me because I spent so much time at church, and they'd just be really cruel and like, you love Jesus, you know, Jesus and Pippa kissing in a tree. And now two of those brothers are really very, have a very strong relationship with the church and Jesus. So it's interesting that they've ended up being church people. And I've ended up creating a alternative to church in Sunday assembly.
So you once told me that you, at Christmas, you'd go home and compete about how many churches you'd planted.
Sunday assembly
churches, and there's more traditionally Christian churches.
One of my brothers, he started another church, or was involved in the beginning of another church in Birmingham. And it just became a little bit, we've got 70 Sunday assemblies around the world. Mm-hmm. Poor little chick.
Sibling rivalry.
Yes.
On a mass ecclesiastical scale. Do you mind if I see... Part of the reason this is a great job for me is I'm just sort of deeply nosy. But you said that quite casually. I just stopped believing in God.
Yeah.
Tell me what was going on around then. What would you say maybe your reasons were? What happened?
So many things. And I remember...
Maybe your diary tells you.
No, it doesn't actually. Interestingly, it stopped. I was very sort of strict about keeping it for about a year.
Yeah.
And then it just almost every 5 months I write something. And there's just one entry that says... I don't go to church anymore, I've stopped believing in God, and I feel very lonely. And that's what it says. It's sad, isn't it? Poor little pips. I know that was true. But I think there was several things. One of my... in fact, I was reminded of it. A Christian singer that I was very into and loved was revealed to have had an affair and cheated on his wife and four children. And I felt like he'd been so holy and pure on stage. Not pure in that... But he seemed like such a good guy, and then he'd done something that seemed to me, you know, at that age, everything's so unforgivable, isn't it? Because it's so black and white. And maybe if that was now, I'd probably be a bit more open-minded about it. But I remember that being real, like, what? This person that was supposed to be leading us all to the Lord has behaved in such a horrible way. So I mean, that was one first thing. And then another thing was, a friend of mine had like the worst life. She had like a horrific life. Everything went wrong. Terrible parents, staff, sort of EastEnders style stuff that you go, surely people don't treat other people like this.
Yeah.
Horrific. And I remember thinking, and she was a churchgoer, and I remember thinking, come on, this can't, like, why, if you care about, so how can this be what God thinks? And I think it's also about my quite naive picture of what God was, the idea that God was a man in the sky with a beard who was looking after me.
Yeah.
So this very, the idea that there's someone who's had a plan and drawn it all out and they know what's best for you.
Yeah.
And then one other thing was a girl in my year at school killed herself. And at the funeral, they didn't really acknowledge that that happened in a... It was a Roman Catholic church. And there's something around, I don't know, Catholicism, so please don't let me offend anybody, but I believe there's something about it being a sin to take your own life. And so it just wasn't talked about. And I felt like, what is this? And her father said in his eulogy, he said, we prayed all weekend for her to come back. We prayed to God that he would bring her back, but I guess he was busy that day. And I remember it's like it smashed me in the chest.
Yeah.
Oh God. I think those were all, and they're all quite close together, those things. So I think those all contributed. And then as I was getting a bit more complex in my questions, maybe as a teenager, maybe the church I was going to, I couldn't find the people who were able to deal with my questions. Maybe. Yeah. Interestingly, my brother got married last year in the church that I'd had this very strong experience of God in. And this man was there, Gordon, who I remembered and always thought was great. And I was like, Gordon, oh my gosh. And we talked about it. And I said, oh, I guess you've heard about Sunday Assembly. And I felt a bit, it's not an anti-religious thing at all. If anything, it's a homage to what I wish that there was a way that I was able to partake in a faith. And he said, oh yeah, I always remembered you. And Sunday Assembly didn't surprise me, because one day, my biggest memory of you is one day all the children had to make a fish. So this must have been when I was 11 or 12. To make a draw a fish and colour it in. And then there was a big fish on the wall and we all put our fish in the fish.
Yeah.
And it was like, we're all God's fish. Whatever. I mean, something to do with the 5,000 activities. Whatever. Yeah, we've got nothing to do. Quick,
yeah.
Draw a big fish. And he said, everyone stuck their fish inside the fish, facing the way of the fish. Apart from me, we stuck it outside the fish, facing the wrong way. And I thought, wow, that's amazing.
Prophetic word.
Interesting, isn't it? Actually, yeah. Well, yeah, it does speak out to me now. But I do think there's something about this. I think the word God is so problematic because of its baggage.
Mm-hmm.
In that, when a lot of us say God, we think of old man in sky.
Yeah.
And actually, so I've got a friend who says, well, I just believe that God is love. Yeah. So if God is an energy that connects us all, then maybe I do believe in God. But that's like a massive kettle of fish.
There's a theologian, I can't remember his name, who talks about God is... We use this word God, but God is not a proper noun. God is not a name. Like, it's a category. It's always, you need to be really specific. Which one do you mean?
Yes.
And what are the qualities and the attributes of God? Because I remember very clearly working, doing some of the stuff at the RSA where we first met on the spirituality report, and feeling like it was the hardest thing to talk about. That actually people from different traditions and backgrounds and disciplines could talk about spirituality, we could talk about practice, we could talk about mindfulness, we could talk about meditation, we could even sort of talk about scripture and kind of moral guidance, but at one point I said, I need to drop the G-bomb here. We need to actually put the subject of God somewhere in this conversation, even though it makes everyone feel a bit squirmy and icky, because it's God has the elephant in the room. is often what's coming up in these things.
Yeah, and it's very interesting, isn't it? Because I think one of the things people find hardest to understand about myself is that I do not believe in God, but I totally respect people who have a spiritual faith.
Yeah.
And I think that's very hard to understand, because I suppose I just see the good stuff of it. And I suppose it comes back to maybe what is known as naive spirituality, and maybe seeing I don't believe in God as I don't believe that there's a person in the sky at a desk designing stuff. So when I say that,
nor do I.
Yeah, exactly. And so I feel like in many ways we probably do believe in the same thing. It's just that you have a particular scripture and guidebook that you go with, which probably isn't dissimilar to mine. And but how do you talk about that in a way that doesn't feel like I'm better than you?
Yeah. I'm closer. My version of God is closer than yours.
Yeah. But even then, it's like, for me, it's that word God is so problematic that
yeah.
I don't even want to say I believe. It's not discuss. Can we discuss God if the word itself is the problem?
So one of the things that we attempted at the RSC thing was this slightly clunky philosophical word, the objective transcendent, something beyond us, something beyond the world, something maybe behind the world. It sounds like you, some days at least, maybe do believe that.
But again, for me, it's like energy. So it's kind of, it's that feeling you get when so. I do a lot of improvisation, and I think that's the closest you can get to God. And the reason for that...
That is a great strapline for your work and some improv comedy advertising.
Yeah. That's Edinburgh next year, sorted. It is these moments. So Showstopper, let me just explain Showstopper. Because I do think that's what the other thing is. I think you can be a theologian and everything, but that God, inverted commas I'm using, is present in everything. And that, so I think it's the connection between human beings that cannot be explained.
Mm-hmm.
So in Showstopper, we improvise full West End style musicals just create them. But the idea is that they are at that level. So we are creating something ridiculously high end.
But with no preparation.
But with no preparation other than we've worked on our skill. So it's like a football match, you know, you can have a football match. And when we're just all there creating the show, singing these songs that are so strong with emotion, and we're all there together, and you think there's 10 people on this stage at this moment and creating this idea of the, the extra note, the harmonic or whatever, the thing that is only the sum of all of us.
Yeah.
And it's such a magical moment, and we all have this energy feeling around us of something magical is happening much bigger than ourselves.
Yeah.
And I think that is the closest you can get to feeling God if you don't have a spiritual practice.
Yeah.
So maybe improvisation is my spiritual practice in a way.
Yeah.
Because it is connecting with people in a way that is not just verbal.
Yeah.
But there's some kind of physiology, is that a word?
Yeah. In terms of kind of our public conversations and how we talk to each other, you know, some things I've learned from you is this sense to really listen to the other person before you are, you know, if you're just thinking about the thing you're going to say next, then this isn't going to work. You're not going to build anything together because you've got to listen to the other person. And then don't get defensive. Don't try and take things in a different direction. Say yes and try and build something together. And that feels like two quite simple but reasonably... would be significantly useful tools if we could think about when we encounter people that are different from us, starting there. Does that feel like a reasonable thesis to you?
Well, yeah, I think that is very reasonable, but I suppose the difficulty comes when you encounter a gut feeling. Mm. So there's our cerebral feeling, I think. So in an improv show, for example, you want the scene to be about Pancake Day, right? And someone comes on stage and starts talking about going to the moon, but you really wanted to, for some reason, to do a scene about Pancake Day. You need to drop your idea and follow the moon person.
Yeah.
But in a conversation, if someone's talking about something very so if you say, for example, we're talking about Christianity, and I just start being aggressively anti-Christianity,
yeah,
for you to yes and that,
yeah,
is sort of carrying on. But I don't know, maybe we should try it.
This is now, I'm feeling definitely out of my comfort zone, but as we know, one will see, all good. So I might say to you, it sounds like the moment that you stopped believing in God was much more emotional than rational.
Well, that's easy for you to say because you want to say that because it's hard for you to hear that there is no God.
Yes, and... Am I getting it?
Yeah.
Yes, and it is hard for me that you don't think there's a God. And I think that I didn't... That emotion is a good thing and a positive and not a worse reason to stop believing in something. just a different and related reason.
So then do I assign you?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
So, but I think it is good because, you know, then you're still talking from your own point of view. So if I came back at you again with, I don't know, you're just... But you're not hearing me. You're not hearing that there's no God. You're still saying there is a God. So so how can we even have... So you're not really listening to me.
Yeah. So at this point, I think... I instinctively would move away from. So what the way I try and do this when I'm in conversations and public events and things with people who really are quite hostile, or on Twitter, quite often if I've done a thought for the day, the kind of backlash from people who would rather there was not any religious content, is very, very hostile. And perhaps rather than saying yes and, I just don't get defensive. But try and get to the heart of what's going on there and say, you know, I'm really sorry to hear that. And why do you think that? And, you know, ask questions and do that kind of journalistic thing of trying to draw out them personally and where they come from and their perspective and their set of lenses so I can understand where is this hostility coming from? Because we're feeling creatures. And part of what I think is going on in the public debates is we're all constantly in fight or flight.
Yes.
Because we all feel...
because we've got 140 characters.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. And we feel defensive and we not, you know, we feel tribal and we feel like our identities are sometimes under threat or our country's under threat or our nation is under threat or, you know, all these kind of things. So one of the things that I think is common to a kind of more sort of slightly journalistic and other-led form of communication and improvising is this, one, staying calm, which is hard, and two, constantly thinking about who's the person that I'm talking to.
But is that, how much do you think that's because of social media being introduced? So many of these conversations we're witnessing are on social media, be that a response on Twitter or a Facebook post or something, reading an article online and then there's comments box underneath. So, and those just aren't great places because you cannot hear the tone and you cannot see someone's eyes, and I really believe that the secret to all the world is in the other person's eyes.
Yeah.
And we say that again in improvisation all the time. Don't look at the floor, don't look at the sky, look in your partner's eyes, because that's where the answer to it is.
Yeah.
And recently with the hashtag MeToo campaign, had quite an interesting experience, which if you're listening in 3 years' time, if you're listening in 2020, this was a big thing that everyone forgot about very quickly, as they often do with such issues. But there was the hashtag MeToo, and I put a post on Facebook about just saying, you know, hashtag MeToo, and just saying, you know, essentially, to put it in a paraphrase, what I wrote was, we need to think about how we're training girls and boys to live in the world because we're training girls to apologise and men to be aggressive. Agree with that or whatever is fine. But a man came on, someone I vaguely know, but he said, you know, I don't really get it, I don't really understand. And a couple of ladies quite sort of jumped on him because he was being a bit ignorant.
Yeah.
And then he got very defensive. And he left and he has now blocked me and lots of people. And I feel sad about that because, for two reasons. One, because he's someone that needs to be having these conversations, but he'd chosen the wrong space to do it in. There's something about if someone jumps on you, the first thought should be, I wonder why this person is jumping on me, rather than, well, you're obviously cruel. It's like, if, you know, again, if I said something that you found very offensive, I would hope to understand why you found that offensive rather than decide you're an idiot. But it, like, a bit like something you said in the introduction, it's so much easier to find the people who agree with us than it is to have go into that slightly murky space.
And you know, there's so many studies that are the people that we follow on social media and the media that we read is basically self-reinforcing. You know, the things that we already believe will be told are true, which means that when we come across someone who says something different, quite often it feels quite harsh because we're not used to it, and it triggers all these kind of emotional reactions in us. And it might be that those women jumping on your friend on Facebook felt you know, the crusade to help him understand, and but actually what might have been the best thing to do is to say, okay, well, you know, this is the background, thanks for asking the question, like, let me help you understand, like the whole thing with dads and daughters, you know. I felt really sad this week for a load of men who'd gone suddenly, oh wow, sexual harassment's a big problem and I've got daughters, and therefore now I care about it, but, you know, full stop, yes, now I care about it, and got beaten with massive sticks because they hadn't expressed it quite right. And, you know, there's all kinds of problems with that. Of course there is. But next time, why would they express, you know, solidarity? And it feels like these ever kind of fracturing, increasing tiny little communities within which we have a common language are getting smaller and smaller and further apart.
But I think it's also dangerous to say maybe we're better. It's like I think that's the other thing, is there's no single way for this. It's almost like it's a flow chart. You know, you need to come into a situation and go, you know, I want to ask more questions about sexual abuse. It is really hard for strong men who've never experienced what it's like to have their ass rubbed constantly, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of women who these things happen to. So for us, it's kind of incredulous that someone would even question it.
Yeah.
And also the old, it's just a bit of fun. But, and so if someone says, oh, it's just a bit of fun, and it just happens to be on the day that you've had this argument 5-6 times, that's the time that you explode.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, so today is the time when you have to go, oh, I've made someone explode, I wonder why that is. Let's ask the question. But it's not necessarily, maybe that's the time I don't have the patience to say, I'm sorry, you know. And the ladies who jumped on the chat were friends of mine, and they're just frustrated with having to have this conversation all the time. Yeah. It's like, how can I, why still click on that hashtag and read 1,000 accounts of what happened to people?
Yeah.
But at the same time, like you say, another approach would have been to say, oh, I see what you're saying, and we can have a gentle conversation about it. But
it takes a huge amount of discipline, takes a huge amount of patience, takes a huge amount of kind of emotional security and resources to be drawn on from elsewhere to keep talking across difference in a way that doesn't give in to that incredibly human temptation to just lose it and to start.
Which is, again, I think the problem with the Facebook is you're actually starting a conversation with the person who put the post up, but it's open to whoever's seen it. So you're actually going to end up having a conversation with more people than you wanted to anyway. Yep. So it's also about, where am I having this conversation and who am I having it with? Do I really want to understand, or did I put this post up because I want people to see that I disagree with it? Like, what's my actually... It's also that. It's like, what is my inspiration for doing anything?
Yeah.
Like, what do I... What's my intent? What's my intention behind these arguments? Is my intention that I'm just annoyed with Elizabeth Oldfield going on about her spirituality?
Yeah.
Or is it that I really want to understand what your relationship is with God and how that works alongside mine?
I'm going to pause this conversation with Pippa Evans for a moment to hear what is going on with the Theos team. And I'm here with Simon Perfect, who works in research around education at Theos and is also a teaching fellow at SOAS. Simon's working with another colleague, Ben Ryan, on a project around universities. Tell us a bit about that.
So this is a new project that we've just started launching. Religion and belief in universities is an increasingly important issue. It's a political issue now, as well as dominating a lot of media discourse. So now is the time for us to be doing some real research about what is actually going on when it comes to religion and belief in universities in the UK. So our research has got two main elements. The first of it is a kind of national mapping exercise where we are trying to work out what different student societies exist in all universities across the country that are focusing on religion and belief.
And unbelief?
And unbelief as well, so including atheist, humanist and secular societies. So we're interested in how many there are, what are they doing, where are they distributed. So a national mapping exercise, which no one's really done before. And then we're also going to do 6 case studies focusing on different universities around the country, different types of universities as well. We'll be going and camping out in those universities for about a week.
Reliving your student experiences?
Absolutely, can't get away from it. And we'll be speaking to as many people as we can, students involved in different societies, to find out what are they doing And most importantly, what are the kind of controversial issues around religion and belief on campus, and how do they manage it? How are these societies dealing with issues like freedom of speech, like questions about conservative social or political perspectives on different issues to do with whether it be Brexit or abortion? How are those kind of issues dealt with? And the key kind of question that we're interested in is, what, if anything, do these student societies focusing on faith and belief contribute to building social cohesion on campus? How can they be encouraged to foster a more cohesive and peaceful campus? And we're taking that angle to try and get away from narratives which tend to assume that all these student societies are somehow problematic. We're trying to focus on the positives here.
Brilliant. Well, we await that research. One element that you've mentioned is about freedom of speech, and I certainly have found your recent long read for the Theos website on freedom of speech on universities immensely helpful, immensely careful, thoughtful primer on the issues. So if our listeners remember one thing about the freedom of speech on universities debate, which is currently very energizing columnists in particular, what would you like them to take away?
The key point I would take away from this is we need to get beyond the simplistic narratives that tend to be dominating this whole discourse. The key simplistic narrative is that students are snowflakes. This term that's used to mean that they cannot take criticism, or they cannot stand opposition to their particular views. I work at a university, and I'm only speaking from my perspective, but I see no evidence that this is the case. But this is a narrative that has got political salience. It's supported by different political or lobby groups for a particular purpose. And actually, we need to move beyond that generalization and do some real research to find out, okay, if there are issues with freedom of speech in universities, what are the issues and why are they there, rather than just assuming that it's because these students cannot take criticism or cannot engage in meaningful debate. So moving beyond those simplistic narratives is the key thing.
Wonderful. Well, I would urge you to go and check out that long read on the website to get up to speed on that important area. Simon, thanks so much for talking to us. And now we're going to continue our conversation with Pippa Evans. Let's loop back around a little bit. I'm aware that some of our people listening might not know exactly what Sunday Assembly is.
So Sunday Assembly is a secular congregation that celebrates life. We have a motto which is live better, help often and wonder more. And it was born out of the idea that there wasn't a secular space that was a space to ask big questions, to connect with the world around us, that wasn't anti-religious. Mm-hmm. And that was the big thing for both of us, myself and Silas and Jones, who I started with, that it should be a celebration of life rather than, say, a science-based critical thinking space or a specifically atheist space. So one of the things we say is, you know, we don't do the supernatural, but we won't say you're wrong if you do. Mm-hmm. And that's a big part of it. So it's a space to come and reflect. You come in, it's very much based on a cross between a church service and a comedy show. And that being simply because that's our background. We were two comedians and we came up with the idea on the way to a gig and had no idea how it would take off, which has been incredible. And so it's, you come in and we sing pop songs instead of hymns. We have a poet instead of reading from text. And we have a speaker, sort of TED-type talk on a theme. And then we have a moment of reflection where we all sit together in silence. And it's paid for voluntary, so anyone can come, but there is a collection. So it's paid for by donations. And then outside of the actual assembly, we have things like peer-to-peer support groups, where someone can come along, and it's like an 8-week long course where you just are with a group of your peers and you say, I want to achieve X, or I'm worried about this, and they support you for those 8 weeks. And other things like service projects and stuff. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's very much based on that idea of, the church model.
And when it first launched, it felt quite different in the atheist space. And you've said, in the atheist space, you've said about not being anti-religious, and that being quite important to you and Sanderson, but it was immediately labelled as the atheist church. And I gather there was a bit of confusion about why you weren't being more hostile.
It got called the atheist church because it's like actually a great shorthand, isn't it? Atheist church for people who don't believe in God. But all those labels, you know, even humanists, you know, so I agree with a lot of the humanist principles, but having a label on you of what you are, I think I find it limiting rather than helpful in terms of spirituality and faith, because I'm in this space of, you know, I'm probably an agnostic rather than atheist. So then I feel like, well then, can I be a humanist? I don't know. I don't know what the rules are. So I just avoid it. So it was very important to me that shouldn't actually be important. So the thing that upsets me most about religion is the labelling of it. So the idea that once you say I'm a Christian, someone goes, ching, 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 ching. Mm-hmm. This is what a Christian is. And the same with humanists or even atheists. You know, what is an atheist in your head? The atheists I came across, I have to say, during my time since Sunday Assembly, have generally been very aggressive men in black t-shirts and black headscarves. But is that what an atheist? No, of course not. That's just the loudest ones, you know. So yeah. Do we always have to be painted by the picture of the loudest ones? So this is a space to explore what you are. You know, we've had people come to Sunday Assembly and it's made them go back to church because they came to the space and realised that's what they... Actually, no, I do. I am a Christian. We've had other people come who've gone, thank goodness, this is exactly what I needed, having been thrown out of a religious... space, you know. So it's a really, really important space because, yeah, literally people whose families have turned their back on them because they decided they didn't believe in God, which seems incredible in the UK, you know, that happens. But also, obviously, now we have, I think, 50 in America, and that's obviously a very, areas are very religious, areas are very religious. What does that mean? Some very religious bits. And so... So, for example, Nashville is, you know, the Bible Belt. And so they have quite a strong amount of people who've come from church backgrounds and been.
Yeah. How old is Sunday Assembly now?
5 years, yeah.
Oh. So Seals was launched 10 years ago. That was when The God Delusion was published. There was quite a lot of, look, a little, you know, mano a mano going on here, quite literally at the time. It feels to us like certainly the atheist community, communities, let's always use communities, that's better, has maybe shifted or changed in tone, and that very kind of peak nasty, really, peak shrill, not least because of Richard Dawkins' sort of gradual public implosion, but the other things going on, has settled a bit. Do you feel now that people are more... Do you see more people showing up sort of... feeling that they can be not religious but not necessarily hostile to it?
You mean as in atheists not being shrill, coming and still enjoying it?
I mean, your men in black t-shirts and black headscarves, are they losing the grip on the kind of public profile?
Well, I think it's important to mention that the reason they were shrill is because it was the only way to get their voice heard. So they were shouting above a very loud noise, which was saying, you know, that the church should have a lot. But at the same time, if you're not super anti-church and you're still questioning what it is, where is that space? And that's the Sunday Assembly space. So we do have people who come. We have people who organise Sunday Assembly who are very big or involved in the atheist world. Mm. And they think of it as different hats. So they have their atheist campaigner hat, which they take off when they come into the Sunday Assembly door, and replace it with a Sunday Assembly hat, which is more on their, almost like their spiritual development. Mm-hmm. As to whatever that is, recognising that they need that to be fed within them. Yeah. That's not to say there's still a lot of people who think Sunday Assembly is the worst thing that could have ever happened to atheism, because it weakens it in their eyes, because
it's giving some ground and saying there's some good stuff here.
Yeah. and you'll say, you know, but I think if people have done something for 2,000 years, there must be something in it, you know. You know, there must be something in it.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a lot of difference between the church and churches. So there have been some institutional big issues with the church.
Yeah.
But in terms of the good work that individual churches do, it's incredible.
Well, we know from our research that actually when you sort of strip away the polemic, being properly committed to a faith community is just good for you, your mental health, your general well-being, your physical health, and that in terms of local communities, embedded faith communities in lots of areas now are the only ones left standing and doing just an enormous amount of good in their communities, which part of our frustration, my frustration, is the kind of narrative about religion is so, for some understandable reasons, so toxic and mainly about abuse, paedophilia, you know, terrorism, power grabs, institutional infighting. Whereas the kind of big picture of what it means in people's lives and on the ground is the sort of the flip side of that. Mm-hmm. It's almost entirely positive. Why do you think that's come about? Is there anything we can do about it?
What changed the narrative? To be honest, I think the church would have to lose some of its power. I think that's the only thing. Need to see a bit more equality and having actually, you know, was it? I think it was Prince Charles said when he becomes the king, he wants to be defender of the faith, not defender of the faith, which, you know, might be one of the only sensible things ever said. You can cut that if you have to. But you know what I mean? And I think there's truth in that. And I think what we need to see actually is more representation of all the faiths, including those who have no faith. So even like Thought for the Day, mm-hmm. I'd love to do a Thought for the Day.
I'd love you to do
that. They never asked me to do a Thought. And, you know, and I think that's the voice they also want to hear is the secular voice who is thinking about the bigger pictures, because there is a sort of a... you know, is it 52% of the UK now identify as non-religious?
Yeah.
And that's a big old chunk. Yeah. So who's talking for them, you know? Because there's a sort of suggestion there that if there's... And Thought for the Day is not, you know, a straw poll of the world, but there's a suggestion there that therefore only 48% of the country should be represented in having thoughts. So believe it or not, the non-religious also have thoughts and think about big questions like death and life and how am I going to get through the day, and you know, so I suppose to change that narrative, people need to be less maybe fearful of the church, or see it as just another part of another option, you know. It's an option rather than you're in or you're out.
I think this question of kind of religion, religious power and privilege is really interesting, because it's so at the heart of some of the disagreements that believers and unbelievers have. But people's perspective on it is so different. So I'll talk to some of my really great friends like you who are non-religious, who perceive the church as having quite a lot of power and privilege and sort of institutional position, a lot of it historical. And then I talk to kind of Christians out and about, you know, if I'm doing field work in a state in the Northeast, talking to a church that, you know, runs all this amazing social action stuff, and I'll be talking to the Christians there, and they feel like the church has almost no power and privilege. You know, they feel, rightly or wrongly, sometimes nervous about being themselves in public, in institutions, in places. You know, they might get some of the language wrong, or they might accidentally say something that makes them sound like a homophobe, or they're just aware of some of people's baggage around religion. And therefore, for them, something like Thought for the Day, or the equivalent on Radio 2, or, you know, perhaps they're being a church or being in a primary school at the end of their road, they tell me they find that just sort of encouraging, because they can see something of them and their values in the wider culture that makes them feel a bit less like a complete weirdo, or slightly less right on the margins.
Mm.
And I sort of hear the validity of both of those arguments. I'm really no idea what the answer is, but it does come back to, what, you know, in a kind of plural public space where there's all these identities rubbing up against each other, what does privilege mean? What does power look like? How are we kind to each other? How are we fair to each other? How do we level the playing field enough so that both no one group or no one person has more access to power, but also that in those more subtle ways everyone feels like they can come kind of authentically, even if they, you know, they need to be well-mannered and kind and, you know, not an idiot, but, you know, they can come and have different views on the world and believe different things and talk reasonably with each other.
But again, it comes back to baggage, doesn't it? Baggage of words. What's your intention? What's your intention when you say I'm a Christian? Like, what do you want? What's the actual information you're trying to get across there?
Yeah.
That is it, I have a faith in God? Is it I am a generous person? Is it that I have values? Because again, a Christian, you know, that's the why we have so many different denominations of church, is because people went, oh, well, actually, I don't understand this kind of church. I'm going to start my own church, you know. And people do just start churches all over the shop. Yeah. You know? People start their own little churches, and there's churches in people's front rooms that we don't even know about, you know.
Yeah.
We think of, when you say church, even, you think of big cathedrals or whatever, but actually... Yeah, people's front rooms are churches. And again, that's, I suppose, for me, that's what Sunday Assembly is the new flavour.
Yeah.
And soon there will be tons of flavours of segregation. I mean, that's a Freudian slip, if ever there were one. But, of non-denominator, funny on my words. Let's start that
situation.
A new flair, there'll be lots of flavours of secular churches or gatherings of that kind, which there already are in some ways, and it's just about what's the difference between, say, something like Sunday Assembly and a hiking group. Like, why would you create that? And I think it's to do with this thing of, where do I go when I have big questions that maybe I don't even want to ask someone?
Yeah.
I just want a space that I can consider and ponder, which isn't that I don't have to also climb up a mountain.
Yeah.
But, you know, climbing up mountains is a good place to ask those questions.
Yeah.
But where am I going to go? Where's somewhere that I can hear different versions of the world and hear different ideas and decide whether I like them or not, not be told this is the one way to do things.
So I think a lot of Christians listening to this, and I hope there's people from all different sets of beliefs listening to this, but for Christians listening to this, a lot of them will be thinking, well, that's what church is for me. Or that's how I first encountered church. That actually this idea that most churches, and some do, obviously, will kind of hand down a prescribed way of looking at the world. My hunch is it's not most people's experience. That actually, very often, they are these places for people questioning, for people wrestling, trying to gather around this sort of perplexing, wonderful, attractive person of Jesus who... We're sort of looking at squint and thinking, oh, there's something very compelling there. I don't really understand it. And doing that together and creating, quite open spaces for, you know, with a flavour, as it were. Not a kind of, I am an objectively laying out all the options, but certainly not, not didactic, not so, I guess, finger-wagging as people think church is. Is there... I don't really know what my question is, but is there, for those people who came to the Sunday Assembly and decided actually what they did want was to go back to church, what might have helped them? What might churches have been able to do to, I guess, get that message out?
Infrastructure, mainly.
Tell me more about that.
Well, the fact that churches have already a way of organising, and I think the hardest thing we found with Sunday Assembly is, yeah, who is in charge if there isn't a clear... dogma or whatever hierarchy or vicar type person, you know. So myself or Sanderson hosts, but I would never wish, you know. One of the big things was in Sunday Assembly, we have a bit called Blah Blah Is Trying Their Best. Originally it was Pippa Is Trying Her Best. And the reason I put that in is because I wanted there to be a human element of, yes, this whole assembly is about, I don't know, living a full life, let's say. But here's a 5-minute testimonial of me failing to do that whilst attempting to do it.
Yeah.
And how important it was to show failure. So maybe that's the bit of church that people don't get to see, is the human side of someone trying to live a good Christian life and failing.
Yeah.
And so that image of sort of the pious Christian is still so strong.
Yeah.
Because we don't get to see... I don't know, Bear Grylls, he says he's a Christian, isn't he?
Yeah.
And so he's probably there. I'm sure the church were very excited to be like, thank you, Bear Grylls, finally a cool Christian. Exactly. You know, and things like that haven't helped over the years. But what am I trying to say? I think what churches do is have a stronger structure and make people feel safe, because there is a vague promise of an answer. And I get a lot of pamphlets from my door of all the churches around. There's quite a lot of churches around here, and some of them promise me that I will be richer, that I will have friends, that I will find love, you know. They make all these promises, and those are churches rather than Christians, I would say. And wow, great, what a great thing if you felt you could do that. And that's much more than Sunday Assembly can promise you.
We
can't promise you anything other than the space to feel sort of supported in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's the big thing, is the infrastructure. But then again, you know, we're only 5 years old, so maybe in 2,000 years, everyone will be hating on us. Yeah.
I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because what you've talked about sounds like an echo or a reworking or reimagining of the practice of confession, of that in a church service, saying, I don't do the things I want to do. Like, I can't live up to my own standards, God. I can't live up to your standards. Like, thank God for grace. Thank God for forgiveness. So something that should be so obvious for Christians, and I think is really close to a lot of our kind of experience of it, this idea that brokenness is kind of normal, natural, and okay, and we're still loved, being quite a sort of liberating idea. But the fact that doesn't come through in public at all, that people feel judged by Christians, even if that's never the intention, or sometimes probably is the intention, you know. So I think there's a real disconnect between what should be coming through and what is coming through.
Yeah, well, what's our experience, you know, with Christians? For me, I mean, this is outside my experience having been in a church, and it really, I think if I hadn't had that experience of being in a church, which was very positive, I probably wouldn't be as positive about Christianity. And obviously with my brothers, who are wonderful human beings, so I can only see the positive from their point of view, really. But I get knocked on my door and told, you know, I've got the answer, and there's something very intrusive about that. Mm-hmm. I was on the tube, and I was chatting to this American guy, and he was so charming. We were having a really nice chat, and he went, "The thing is, I'd like to tell you about my friend Jesus Christ." And I just felt like I'd been had. Like, yeah. Oh, you weren't connecting me with me, actually. You just wanted to sell me your product. Right. And I think that's the maybe the hardest bit, is you're trying... How can someone be... sure that you're genuine in the offering of Jesus Christ as a product.
Yeah.
You know, why are you trying to sell me this thing? Is it because you get ultimate salvation, or is it because you genuinely think it's going to help me? And how can really someone knocking on my door know that when they don't know me? And I think that's the problem, is it's like one size fits all.
Yeah.
That attitude towards it. And the same with Sunday Assembly, we have the same problem, which is, in a way, which is... trying to explain to people, you might not like this.
Yeah.
You know, you're a non-believer. This might not be the way you want to be a non-believer, because you might not like pop music. We have people say, "I hate the songs you sing."
It's like,
either go and start your own thing, or maybe you don't need this. Like, this is a specific thing for people that need a congregation, that feel like they're lonely in London. Like, it's very popular in cities, and that's because people are on their own, working too hard, and find it impossible to make personal connections.
Yeah.
And it's so much easier to go into a space and make personal connections if... there's a motto: live better, help often, wonder more. If you're coming into that space, you probably agree with that motto. So you've already got a baseline of, I want to be a better person, I want to help other people, and I want to be inspired by the world.
Yeah.
So there's that. I think that's the big thing, is where's the space that I meet other people who have a similar attitude towards the world?
Yeah. In terms of thinking about how we talk to each other in public, how particularly believers and non-believers talk to each other, we, you know, you and I both see the extreme ends of... religious people and the extreme ends of atheists, sort of, you know, tanking it out in public debates or on Twitter, or, you know, writing columns against each other and all those kind of things. I think both of us think it's not representative. Given that, fairly kind of deeply embedded in certainly in Christian faith, and I think in other faiths, is this sense of gift of having received something good, and therefore the instinct to at least, you know, offer it or share it or invite it, or at least, you know, help people be more informed about it, is probably not going to go away. What are the ways that you've maybe seen that done that are the least annoying? And what are the things that people definitely shouldn't do, whether that's tone or tactic or...
Yeah, I think I'm a big fan of show, don't tell, you know. Why, you know, it's saying, it's how annoying is it when someone says, I don't know, I'm gonna write a book, actually. I'm gonna write a book, it's called My Ideas About the World.
Yeah,
I'm gonna definitely write a book. And then you see them again to go, "Hey, how's that going with that book?" "Oh yeah, oh yeah, it's definitely on its way, it's definitely..." And it never happens, they never write the book. But they just want you to know about the book. And I sometimes feel that about the knocks on the doors and the people on the guy in the tube, because I'd rather just see it. Like, the people to me who make me go, wow, you can really gain a lot from church, are my brothers and my friend Lucia, and I probably include yourself in this as well, and other Christians I know who never bang me over the head with the Bible, but
except
definitely
that one
live.
Time when I, you
except
know,
that one time.
End up in hospital,
yeah,
so
well,
that.
Let's not bring that up right now. Is that I, as I see that your lives are rich in in your souls. So that's much more likely to make me question, maybe I should go back to church. And again, like, I think people who don't believe in God think about that a lot more than Christians maybe do. Of course I think about going to church all the time. I think even when Jonathan was talking about, our friend Jonathan was talking about going in some church in Cornwall and really refinding his connection with Jesus. It's like, I can't swear. But I was like, Jonathan!
Yeah.
So unfair that you found that, you know. Who knows? Like, in 20 years' time, maybe I'll find Jesus again and be like, oh my gosh.
I did miss you. It wasn't just church.
Yeah, it wasn't just church. At the moment, I don't think that would happen. But I think it's really important to be open to those things. And that sort of comes back to these conversations, you know, seeing aggressive shouting at each other doesn't make anyone respond well to either side, really. It's just shouting.
Yeah.
Who's ever really got anything done with shouting, other than maybe your mum at the end of the day when she's so just wants you to go to bed,
right?
And you've only gone to bed through fear for your life,
and you just lie there being angry, don't get to sleep.
Yeah, so that's not the way to change people's minds, and it's a long, slow process.
Yeah.
Why are we always trying to change the whole world's mind rather than the five people at our fingertips?
Pippa, thank you. I feel like I have had my mind expanded and been changed. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I'm great.
Thank you for listening to The Sacred. I hope you'll listen out for future episodes. I'll be talking to Francis Spufford, Andrew Copson, Giles Fraser, and many more. And you can also check out our first episode with Jonathan Rowson. I'm on Theos Elizabeth on Twitter. Please let me know what you think. And I hope that you'll engage with Theos. Our website is theosthinktank.co.uk, or you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook.